Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Eitan Kaslyanich. I'm representing Karen Dexter in this appeal. This is an unusual appeal, probably for you, certainly for me. I've never had an appeal like this, which is on really constitutional issue rather than the 405G, the question of the normal question of is the ALJ's decision supported by substantial evidence and free of legal error. That's not before you today. The issue here is whether Dexter has raised a colorable constitutional claim that imparts jurisdiction to this court. That's the first mount, well, I don't want to call it, I'll call it a hill. First hill we have to climb here, because if she hasn't raised a colorable constitutional claim, you have no jurisdiction. It is our position that she has raised a colorable constitutional claim, several of them, and as a result, you do have jurisdiction to consider the merits of her appeal. And once again, the merits of her appeal, the issue there is not whether or not she is disabled or whether or not the ALJ was wrong in not finding her disabled, because he didn't make a decision about that. The question is, should Ms. Dexter get a hearing on the merits? So let me start by discussing the colorable constitutional claim issue. I note in my briefs that there's one, the facts of this case are mostly pretty clear, but there's one fact that's unusual and unclear, and that is when Dexter was denied at the reconsideration level in April, apparently 2004, the notice that was sent to her apparently has no valid date on it. The date that is stamped on it says APR and the number one. That's all it says. Somebody has written in a number after the one, but there's no year on it. Now, reasonably, we can't, you know, it's not our position that she didn't actually get this at some point in 2004. It was apparently issued in April of 2004. But considering that Ms. Dexter at that time was caring for her mother, who was dying of cancer and was also experiencing many illnesses that were affecting her ability to function, perhaps it's not surprising that seeing this notice that had a date that wasn't a date might not have alerted her to the urgency of filing an appeal.
Well, the letter does specifically, explain to her the time frame within which she had to file an appeal, correct?
It does. And so let's assume,
and she wasn't just a little bit late, she was 11 months late.
She was 11 months late. So let's assume for the sake of argument that the date had even been completely valid, okay?
You have to. You can quibble about it now. But that's not going to get you anywhere.
Exactly. And so assuming that she got this notice, it's April, and she looked at it and just didn't deal with it, couldn't deal with it for whatever reason. The burden is then for her to show that she had good cause for not dealing with it. Now, although there is a rule that says that you have to file an appeal within 60 days of the date you receive the decision, there's also a regulation that says that there's an exception, which is for good cause. If you have good cause for late filing, they will treat your request for hearing or whatever the request is as being timely filed. And when she finally got around to submitting an appeal, she actually submitted the wrong appeal. She submitted a request for reconsideration, which was processed by the local office, and a worker there actually found she also had submitted a good cause statement explaining that her mother was sick, was dying of cancer, then she had died, and in addition, she'd been having her health problems that just overwhelmed her.
What's your best case that says in this kind of context that it's a due process violation to fail to allow an untimely request for this type of procedure?
You know, I'm happy to connect.
You know, when a judge asks a question like that, it usually means that his brilliant law clerks have told him there are no such cases. You agree?
Yes, I do agree. That's what I was.
This is our chance to establish that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you know what we're doing here. It's connecting the dots between a bunch of Supreme Court precedents and Ninth Circuit precedents that discuss these kinds of issues on when, you know. Once again, we're back to the does she have, is she stating a constitutional claim in the first place? And certainly under UDG, she is. UDG didn't file, you know, that case was, what was it, 15, 19 years? It was something like that, sitting before he got around to actually getting an attorney and figuring out that he should be appealing stuff. This was a lot quicker than that, but no, you're right. There's no clear precedent that says what happens when you present good cause and they just ignore it. I think what makes this case a little different, if this case is different from how the posture of it would be, if the ALJ, ALJ Joyner, who had considered her good cause request. And once again, when she filed it as a request for reconsideration, the local worker looked at her reasons on the good cause letter and said, these reasons are good cause for filing a request for reconsideration, and approved it. But then that was a mistake because it was not supposed to be a request for reconsideration.
How is this different than someone has a hearing in the Social Security context before an ALJ and requests a continuance and shows what you or I might think would be good cause, and the ALJ says, look, I've got a patent docket. You had notice of what was going on here today. Your request for continuance is denied. And would that be a due process violation?
It potentially could be a due process violation. It would depend on what
the Rocket Docket in Virginia is unconstitutional?
Well, what I'm saying is that
we have district judges who deny continuances all the time, saying, look, I understand you have good reasons, but I'm going to exercise my discretion not to. Same thing with ALJs. Why does that rise to the level of a constitutional issue?
I think it really is an individual determination there, because for the most part, if you are given your hearing in court, at least potentially there's no constitutional violation. But once again, I'm saying it's a judgment call, because let's say you have an individual who doesn't have counsel as a result of that decision to not grant them the continuance, and their case is not presented properly. I think that does raise a constitutional violation. So I think it's an individualized determination. But that's not...
Doesn't that lead us into the path of widely expanding our review of discretionary decisions?
Okay. What makes this...
If you say case by case, that tells me we're going to see a lot of cases.
Okay. What makes this case different, I think, is that ALJ Joyner, when he determined that she did not have good cause, did not even address her good cause letter, did not address the reasons in her good cause letter, did not acknowledge that the reasons in a good cause letter are explicitly, two of them are explicitly listed in the regulation which he was bound to uphold and comply with.
He addressed one of the grounds. She raised three grounds, right? I didn't know about the deadline. I was ill, and then my mother passed away from cancer. So he addressed one of the three grounds that she raised. But help me out here in the real world. How does these things usually work? So you file a request and you state your good cause, and you're dealing with a lot of lay people, and they say, well, I was really sick, so I blew the deadline. Let's hypothetically speaking, let's not take this case, which was untimely by a long stretch, but let's just take the scenario of somebody who missed the deadline by a couple of weeks, and they write in and say, I was really sick. How does the agency usually handle it in your experience? Because this was a written denial. There wasn't an opportunity to then explain, well, I was sick and I couldn't contact you because I didn't have a neighbor or a friend who could help me out, right, which is the other part that's required under the regulations.
Most of the time when a late hearing request is filed with a letter for good cause, the ALJ grants the request and doesn't even tell you that he's granted the request. The case, just the processing just proceeds, and you almost don't even realize that they've done that. They don't even tell you that they've granted the request, ordinarily. Exactly. The only time they tell you that they've denied your request to allow the late filing is when they determine that you did not have good cause. And let's say you just file late and you don't state any good cause, and it's clear you don't have any good cause. then they are supposed to issue, like what happened here, he did issue a dismissal notice in which he was supposed to explain why his determination, why he did not find it. That was the abuse of discretion here, was not just, he didn't not, it wasn't just that he turned down her request. He didn't even address the issues that she had raised that are clearly examples of good cause in the regulation. I don't know why they would put these examples in the regulation and then and have an ALJ be able to not just, you know, he could have used his discretion and said, well, I see that these are examples in the regulation, but in this case, I just don't think that's good enough. And, you know, then you still, even in that case, that's a tougher case, I think, because he would have at least, you'd at least have some sort of an explanation from the judge you'd be dealing with. But it's still a problem under Holohan, because what you're supposed to be looking at is the private interest that's affected by the official action. And the effect of this action was very large. We weren't asking, she wasn't asking the judge to find her disabled. She was asking him for her day in court, her only possible day in court to prove that she's disabled. And she has a property interest in the disability benefits. But because of the ALJ's action, she was denied any day in court.
So play this out for me on a practical fact. Let's assume that the district court was correct in saying, I mean, and you agree the district court was correct in saying you didn't exhaust. The only question is whether it's excused.
Exactly.
If the district court decision stands, is that over for you in the administrative process, or are you still going to get a final order from which you can take an appeal?
There's nothing to appeal. They've slammed the door on her in 2005, and even though there was a hearing held and new evidence was taken, and that's our other argument, is that the new evidence, including medical expert evidence, that appears to support a finding of disability because of documentation of her limited ability to use her dominant arm, back to her day last year. But once again, the merits aren't here.
Right.
That's for another day, if we get another day.
Now, you're down below three. Do you want to reserve some time?
Yeah, I would like to reserve some time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, Jeff McLean for the Commissioner of Social Security. Plaintiff's counsel concedes that there's no jurisdiction over this case in the normal regulatory framework as put forward by 42 U.S.C. 405G. However, alleges that a colorable constitutional claim exists. I note that most of plaintiff's arguments are related to discretionary decisions by the agency, and that doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional violation as we've seen it in prior Ninth Circuit cases.
But how do we know that discretion was properly exercised if there's no explanation of the reason for the denial?
There's a difference between considering a good cause statement and discussing it in a decision. And Ninth Circuit law has recognized that distinction in the Lockwood case. That's not related to due process. However, in this situation, ALJ Joyner read the good cause statement, considered it, noticed certain elements of the good cause statement, including the statement that she didn't understand that she had a deadline to file, and weighed the fact that she was 11 months late in her filing against the reasons offered in finding that...
Except that the ALJ didn't weigh it against the reasons offered. The reasons, with one exception, weren't discussed. So your argument is we should believe that the ALJ considered it, when actually the document would say the ALJ only considered one reason and weighed it.
That is my argument, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And
why should we credit? I mean, actually, if the ALJ had said nothing, it might be better than to say, I consider this one reason and I'm weighing against it, because the inference is the ALJ didn't consider the other two reasons.
That is an inference that could be made. However, those are the exact kind of questions that aren't subject to judicial review, unless you're going to go so far as to say that that's a constitutional violation of her due process rights.
Well, we've said in the past that procedural due process may require some explanation in order to facilitate review. And what bothers me about this case is that she articulated three reasons, and the ALJ specifically addressed the weakest of the three reasons that could have established good cause.
I understand your concern, Your Honor. However, I don't believe that that merits the finding of a constitutional violation. The types of cases where a constitutional violation has happened in the administrative context have been due to mental incapacity. She's saying that she was very sick. However, she filled out a disability report in conjunction with her good cause statement that indicated that her very sick illness was related to a gallbladder surgery that occurred many months after she already missed her deadline. In that circumstance, I don't believe, A, that a colorable constitutional claim is present based on the facts, or B, that if you found a colorable constitutional claim, that a constitutional violation in fact occurred.
Well, of course, we don't know how the ALJ would have weighed that because the ALJ didn't say. That's your factual argument on appeal, and I credit it, but we don't know what the ALJ thought about that.
I would point the court to the case of Crumpleman v. Massonari. I can provide that citation if you're interested. And in that case, they were reviewing a res judicata decision by the agency, which is also typically not subject to judicial review. And they stated that a constitutional violation only exists if the record is patently inadequate to support the finding of the agency.
It is a consequence of agreeing with the position that the commissioner proposes to encourage laziness on the part of ALJs?
That's a potential consequence, Your Honor.
Should we ignore it?
In my opinion, it's not worth the type of caseload that could result from this kind of determination. You have a situation where if every discretionary determination by the agency is subject to a challenge, in any situation where plaintiff disagrees with the merits of those challenge based on a procedural thing that's clearly discretionary.
So what's the takeaway from this case if there are ALJs out in the audience here?
The takeaway would be, based on the argument here, that the court or that an ALJ should perhaps give greater reasoning. However, the regulatory framework doesn't delineate what reasons are required, how the ALJ is supposed to explain the decision. It just states that there's a discretionary decision at hand and the ALJ must make that decision. The ALJ did so in this case, noting some reasons, if not others, and weighing that against the time frame at issue, which is 11 months, and that's a significant time frame.
I think we understand your argument. Do you have anything to add?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
First, I'd like to quickly point out that Crumpleman's not on point. And in Crumpleman, it was addressed, I addressed it on page 3 in my reply brief. This court noted in Evans that Crumpleman held that no jurisdiction existed for judicial review because the claimant's allegations were purely conclusory, unsupported by facts, and insufficient to withstand summary judgment. Here there's actual legitimate allegations by her, unquestioned allegations, that were not addressed by the ALJ. So Crumpleman's not on point. I think your concern is correct that if this ALJ is allowed to prevent her from ever having her hearing based on not even addressing the good cause allegations that she made, it just means that it obliterates the regulation. It makes it so the regulation has no meaning at all.
So the ALJ in this case, what he or she should have done was say, I've considered carefully every single one of the reasons you've articulated, and I decline to exercise my discretion in your favor, we wouldn't be here.
You know, I might still be here, and it'd be a harder case for you. but the because
I thank you for your candor.
Because under the facts of this case, because she alleged something that was clearly on the list of examples, and it wasn't she had like she'd gone to the list and had found something, said, oh, this one applies to me. The worker asked her, why are you so late? And she said, well, I was taking care of my mom. She was dying of cancer. Now she's dead. it was, you know, what do you know? There's actually a rule that says that if that's your reason for being late, they may find good cause, and it is discretionary.
Well, and then you've got to show why you couldn't have, you know, contacted them through friends or other family members, for example. So taking Judge Hawkins' example one step further, if the AIJ had just said, I've considered your illness and the death of your mother as a potential good cause, but the 11-month delay really weighs against you because you could have asked somebody else to contact us on your behalf, then you'd really be out.
Yes. She's not a real functional individual as far as understanding these procedures. And when you added that her illnesses, which included some severe depression, despite what the government said, and the caring for her mother and the overwhelming how that overwhelmed her, there's a reason it's in the regulation, because that is something that can provide, be a reason that shows good cause for filing late. And that was her reason. And she'd like to have her day in court. That's what this is all about, for Ms. Dexter to actually be able to have a judge listen to her and consider the merits of her disability claim.
Thank you, counsel. The case just heard will be submitted for decision.